For the week of April 13th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 232, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm in Brooklyn today, sunny Brooklyn. I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, you know, Brooklyn is really part of New York when you think about it.
So, it is, you know, yeah. But in New York, you typically, when you say you live in New York City, you mean Manhattan. When you say, when you're in Brooklyn or Queens or the Bronx, you don't say I'm in New York City. You say I'm in the Bronx. I'm in Brooklyn. They got a strong identity and they're proud of it.
Well, I'm just glad you're on top of your game today and you're, you know, you seem to be, you know, on the ball, as they say.
I am. I'm on the ball and I'm looking forward to a consecutive run of episodes that we're going to be doing over the next few weeks and months as we get into the exciting summer season. One brand new episode every single week for weeks and months to come.
Okay. Can we do that in starting in 2 weeks?
Do you have something to tell the folks, Sperling?
I do. I won't be here next week, so we will be taking a week off, but then we will be returning.
Are you having surgery?
I'm not
Are
having...
you going to the moon? Fixing cancer?
I'm fixing cancer? I don't know if anybody's done that. But
what are you doing? You're going on vacation.
Well, it's spring break, so I'm going to Fort Lauderdale.
Nobody goes to Fort Lauderdale for spring break anymore.
Oh, really? Where do they go?
They go to, like, the Panhandle or whatever. Or they go to the Caribbean. They go to other places. But you are going to Mexico.
With my daughters, yes. So I'm going to Mexico with the family.
Great.
Yes. I don't think I will be doing the same thing as I would be doing if I went to all those places you just mentioned.
So while you're away, we'll miss you. But while you're here, what will we discuss this week on the show?
Well, you know, before I tell you what we're going to discuss, can I just say that while I'm away, you can still follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our username is Showbiz Sandbox. You can also subscribe to our show so that when we get back, you can immediately get a new episode. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can also email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
Now you name all those places, but most people, do they go through iTunes or do they go through our website? And, you know, how do they access us?
Through mostly through iTunes, a lot more through Stitcher than ever before, and a lot through the website.
So some people just go to Showbiz Sandbox and play the episode live right there because it's pretty easy. And if there's ever any technical difficulty, like iTunes isn't loading properly, we had that problem a couple weeks ago for some people who don't subscribe, sometimes episodes are not visible. I don't know why. We've never figured that out. But you can always go to Showbiz Sandbox. If you're not finding it somewhere else, it will be there and you can play it off that. I've done that on my phone.
ShowbizSandbox.com.
That's right. So today's show.
Today's show, we're actually going to be going big and large on two different subjects. First, we're going to be discussing the brewing battle over premium large format screens at the multiplex. You might know these types of auditoriums as, well, IMAX, though not for long if your local cinema chain has anything to say about it. Secondly, we'll be discussing how VIP luxuries and amenities are taking over Coachella, one of North America's premier music festivals.
And it's premier because you've attended it.
Well, it's premier because, let's face it, when you're being parodied and satirized on Saturday Night Live, and, you know, you're pretty much a well-known entity at this point.
All right.
In fact, you know, all of these amenities and these luxuries, they've started to eclipse the actual, you know, I guess the music and arts that the event is supposed to be about. But everyone who joins us here in the sandbox on a regular basis knows that kind of lux just ain't for us.
That's right. We're just regular folk.
That's
good
right.
People.
We crave a different kind of buzz. Am I going to get sued for stealing those lyrics?
I keep going.
Okay. Well, that's why we're going to be telling you what it was like to attend this year's Coachella by going over the top. And we don't mean over the top of the fence surrounding the Empire Polo Field at Edendio, California. It's another kind of over the top. Since it's tax time here in the U.S., we figure we should have a story about paying taxes, or more appropriately, not paying taxes, which is what productions of all types, movies, television, theater, they all want to stop paying taxes.
And now we just added a new subscriber, the NSA and the IRS.
That's right. Well, the funny thing is, producers are actually getting their way with the tax man these days. So don't come after us. Go after the producers. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And it's a tight race at the box office. We cover the worldwide box office, of course, because that's what matters. It's covered by RentTrack. That's where we get our figures from. There's a link in our show notes if you want to check out their site. The worldwide box office, the number one film in the world, it's an asterisk because it's so close between number one and number two. It's the closest I've seen since we started tracking this.
On a worldwide basis, yes.
On a worldwide basis, Captain America, The Winter Soldier is the number one film in the world with $101,998,000, almost $102 million worldwide. It's at just under half $1 billion, and it's still got a long ways to go. It's tearing it up every possible way. At number two around the world is Rio 2, the sequel to the animated film about birds. It made $101,300,000, so just about $600,000-$700,000 below Captain America. So that means about, I don't know, what is it, maybe 8 million people around the world went to see Captain America, and another 8 million people went to see Rio 2 all over the world this weekend.
Not only that, but then in number three, you got Noah. This is the film we didn't think would actually, you know, we thought it would drown, get it?
I didn't say it would drown.
Okay,
I
was trying to make a drowning joke, or at least a Noah joke. It made another $43.6 million worldwide.
Well, that's not surprising. It's opening in 54 territories. It's made $246 million. It's not doing great. It's doing okay. They're hoping it'll do better overseas. Domestically, it's sort of falling. The bottom has fallen out of it. People clearly weren't thrilled with it. It's at $84 million in North America. It's going to be lucky to get to $100 million, that may not even count. So this movie needs to make a lot overseas to make up for that. So Rio 2, by the way, is at $164 million worldwide total because it's been open in Brazil and some other territories before this weekend where it really went wide. And number four is Divergent. This is the first in a series of films based on the dystopian novels that are very popular among young adults. They made $30 million. It's at $175 million worldwide. Most of that is North America, where it's made $125 million. But I have to say, it's sort of losing steam, not doing great. And I thought, gee, is it a question mark? Will they absolutely make the sequel to Divergent? They're supposed to make two movies? You know, because
I don't think they're going to make those two movies. I think
they're not.
I think it's like a new trend in Hollywood. Hey, do you have a final book to your young adult series? Then we must chop it in half and make two movies out of it.
It's so annoying. At least the final Harry Potter book was really long. It was like 800-900 pages. There's no reason to turn the final book in Divergent into two movies, but that's what they've done. They said, yes, we are making the sequels. Don't even question that. And we're not going to make two sequels. We're going to make three sequels. So the three books will become four movies. And there you go. It's happened before, though, that they make the first in a series and they don't make any sequels, like The Golden Compass. That was the first of a trilogy. That never got made. Tintin, that's been sitting around for a while, but Peter Jackson insists he is going to make the next movie. He's just got sidetracked by The Hobbit. So
well,
that's where
and he wants to turn that one comic book into 400 movies.
That's right. So that's the worldwide box office so far.
What about Ender's Game? Ender's Game is kind of the same thing, right? They thought, well,
that was not a trilogy. That wasn't a set number of films to tell one long story.
Yeah, true.
So it's different. It's just the beginning of a franchise that didn't work. So it's slightly different because if you don't make the sequel to Divergent, there's no end to your film. Ender's Game has an end. You can watch it beginning, middle, end and be very happy. In fact, you should just read the book or see the movie because the sequels all suck. The number five movie around the world is open in mostly North America. It's Oculus, a horror film. It made $13 million, and it beat out the Kevin Costner football movie, Draft Day. That opened in basically North America only. That's where people care about football the most. It made under $10 million. It could not pass Oculus. It's another soft opening for Kevin Costner. He's sort of making a comeback, making a lot of movies, that's for sure. But he hasn't really reestablished himself as a box office draw.
Now, did you see Draft Day?
No.
I mean, I'm surprised. I don't know how much money they spent on this movie. Ivan Reitman directed it.
Where's he been? It's been a while since he's done something, hasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And now he's dropped out of Ghostbusters, so maybe he'll make Draft Day 2. Or Second Round Draft Day. You know, that kind of I don't know what he's going to do.
More likely, if it worked, they would have made one for baseball and basketball and everything else.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, Kevin Costner stars as this kind of general manager of the Cleveland Browns, which is a real team, a real National Football League team.
Right, they didn't come up with a fake name. And
normally,
a fake team.
They do, because the NFL does not want its image tarnished in any way. So
but there's nothing tarnishing about this movie.
No, not at all. But they tend to not lend or allow movies or producers to use real teams' names because they
So Any Given Sunday was fake?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay, all right.
And their placements, all of these movies, they were all fake teams. However, in this case, the Cleveland Browns are used, and, you know, Kevin Costner's character is the general manager of the Cleveland Browns. And the other team, the team that he's negotiating with to get the first round draft pick, the number one pick, was supposed to be the New York Jets right there in your backyard, Michael. But apparently the storyline was a little bit too close to home.
They got Mark Sanchez and the same thing where a veteran is going to be kicked out and kicked aside by an incoming draft pick. And they're like, we don't need to make this movie right now.
Right. Maybe we shouldn't actually participate.
So they switched it up at the last second to the Seattle Seahawks.
Right. But the funny thing about it is the Seattle Seahawks in the movie have the number one draft pick. They're going to pick the best player, supposedly, of the year, because they have the. But that often goes, almost always goes, to the worst team in the league.
The team with the worst record, yeah, from the previous season.
Ironically, in January, the Seahawks won the Super Bowl, so they have the best record. So go figure.
Well, that's just how it worked out this year.
Right.
So back in Any Given Sunday, there was the Miami Sharks. That was the fictional team that Jamie Foxx was going to take part in on Any Given Sunday with Al Pacino. That was Oliver Stone, I think, directed that.
That's right.
So Draft Day cost about $25 million to make. It opened to $10 million. It's a movie that appeals to older audiences, of course. So it's possible if they like the movie, they'll keep coming back and they'll make their money back. We'll see how it does long term. The opening day can be a sign of great stuff, but it's not necessarily a sign of disaster. You just got to wait to see how it plays out. At number six, for example, is the Grand Budapest Hotel, another $11 million. It passes the $100 million mark worldwide. It's the first time any Wes Anderson film has done that. It's his biggest success by far, and it's not even close to done.
Speaking of not being close to done, how about that Lego movie?
That's right. Another $10 million. It's at $425 million. It was the biggest hit of the year, but now it's been lapped by Captain America, which isn't even close to done yet. And of course, a lot of other movies will pass Lego before the year is over, but still a solid success story. And number nine, another animated film, Frozen. That's at $1.1 billion. Mr. Peabody and Sherman, another $5 million. It's struggling to get to that $300 million mark. It's at $250 million right now. And number 11, another small independent film. Oh, I'm sorry. My mom went to see something else. It's called Heaven Is Not Real or Heaven Is Real, another religious movie that gets released in limited areas all around the country. That movie is doing okay in very small release. And the wide release success story is God's Not Dead. The sequel will be, of course, God Is Still Not Dead. It made $5 million. It's at $40 million. I wonder if they'll open this one up overseas.
Do you think that maybe the sequel will be like, yeah, God's he's not feeling too well. God caught a cold.
That's what the sequels to The Golden Compass were. In that fantasy trilogy, God is dying and, in fact, dies. And it's a battle of heaven and earth. It's Paradise Lost, a retelling of it set in its fantasy world. And God dies in that third book. And, I mean, if you want to know why they were not going to make those movies, I mean, even if the first one was a big hit, you're like, once you look at the script of the second and third film, you go, uh-oh. I don't know if we want to make a big $200 million movie about God dying. I'm not sure people would be down with that.
Well, you know, when it comes to sequels, I don't know. I read this story this week that the Avatar scripts are almost done. They're almost, they're weeks away from being done. And I thought, why am I reading this story? What you're saying is the sequels to Avatar aren't still done. Not yet written.
Well, what happened was James Cameron gave a talk to Reddit, the online website, and he did a chat session, and they pulled some quotes from that for a story in Hollywood Reporter. So that's the reason why a story appeared. But what I loved about this was James Cameron's quote, because these guys, like James Cameron and George Lucas, they have huge success, and then they lose their mind. They lose their mind. This is James Cameron's comment. In terms of storytelling, I'd like to see Hollywood embrace the caliber of writing in feature films that we're currently seeing in the series on television. More emphasis on character and less on explosions and pyrotechnics. And I'm talking the big tempo movies. I think they're obnoxiously loud and fast. End quote. Oh, my God.
Okay, does he see his own movies?
James has terrible screenwriting, and he makes big, loud, obnoxious tempo movies. Is he telling Hollywood not to make his films?
Apparently so.
It's like George Lucas when he said, I don't know why Hollywood makes all these big movies. They should make tiny little $1 million movies. I'm going to now make Star Wars 4, 5, and 6.
Well, no, he made Star Wars 1, 2, and 3. Now, speaking of...
Oh, don't even say that. It's not true, but you're right.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm just tired of reading all these stories about, you know, it's like... Because of these big blockbusters are so important now, as Mr. Cameron...
Well, they're not important. They just need to feed the beast. If they were printing in a newspaper, they wouldn't do stories. But with a blog and a website, you want some email to send out. So the Hollywood Reporter says they've opened up the production office. They've begun costume designing. You know, they just have an hourly update on every big movie.
The production designer has sharpened his or her pencil. Yeah.
or more likely, launched their program.
Yeah, I'm really tired of reading posts about, all these, like... throwaway posts.
Is this a throwaway post? They're bringing back Peter Mayhew as Chewbacca?
Well, actually, is that confirmed? Because, you know, when the Hollywood Reporter had this story, and, you know, when Peter Mayhew was asked, what he said was kind of cryptic.
Cryptic? Well, what did he say? Either he's in it or he's not.
Well, you know, and this is just kind of paraphrasing, but it was...
Oh, my God, I saw that coming right after. You told me to do that, and at the end, I knew what you were doing. Oh, my God. All right.
I set that up before the show, folks, and he walked right into it.
Walked right into it. Okay.
Now, but, you know, I know one place you will almost never walk into.
What's that?
A big IMAX auditorium. Unless it's shot in IMAX... Unless it's meant for IMAX, you, Michael, will probably not be seeing a film in an IMAX theater.
Why throw away your money? It's not a great way to see movies unless you've got a great seat. And if it's not shot in IMAX, why are you paying extra? I urge all of you, don't pay money to see movies in IMAX unless a substantial portion or a majority of the film was shot in IMAX.
But now let me ask you this. What about seeing it in Big D, ETX, Prime or RPX or
well,
Ultra
this
AVX.
Is what drives me nuts. And I went to see a movie at Regal. Was it AMC 25 or Ewok? I know it was the Ewok. Was on the north side of the street.
Wait, are we still on Times Star Wars Square. Here? Because Ewok is
that's right. Ewok is E-W-A-L-K Entertainment okay. Walk. I guess I don't know what it stands for, but that's on the north side of the street of Times Square, and the AMC 25 is on the south side. They're two of the most popular movie theaters in the country, hugely profitable. And I went to see a movie on the north side of the street, and I hadn't bought a ticket, and I had no choice. I had to either wait an hour to see a movie, or I had to pay it to see it in EPX. Is that what it's called? That's one of the formats.
ETX. ETX.
All right, ETX. Phone home.
Or RPX.
So
I
paid the money. It was RPX. I paid the money and an extra, you know, $3 or whatever. And I go in there, I'm like, what the heck is this? It's just a movie theater. It's just a big screen. You know, the screen goes lower to the ground.
That's
right.
They
sort of mimic what IMAX looks like in a way. It's just a screen. It's a normal screen with normal sound. I'm like, this is what every venue in your theater should be like. A well-done screen and good sound. Why am I paying extra for this? But it's working, right? There are
Well, let me just point out something. You cannot get better sound than digital cinema. You're basically getting 5 or 7.1 surround sound or Atmos or Oro, but it's all uncompressed, so it doesn't matter. Now, IMAX does do, you know, a mix for itself. So IMAX is doing...
What's different?
Yes.
But that doesn't mean it's better.
That is correct.
Right. And the sound mix should be the director's sound mix and the sound designer. I assume they do it in consultation with
them. Yes, absolutely.
Right, right. So anyway, it's big business. IMAX has been there for a while. There are 365 IMAX screens in North America. That's outside of museums. Now, the other... theater chains said, you know, hey, let's get in this business. Why not charge extra for a nice screen? So there are now 325 non-IMAX screens known as premium large format. They've right. all got different names, but basically it's just a nice big screen. It's not an IMAX screen. It's just off-the-shelf technology. It's just a normal theater venue. Usually it's the biggest venue in that particular theater. They retrofit it and say, this is our premium theater. You're going to pay extra to sit here.
Well, and last year IMAX... What they made $727 million selling tickets to, you know, Hollywood movies, blockbusters, which is up from 2012 by about 17%. And Cinemark, on the other hand, with
that's just one chain.
That's just one chain here in the United States. They have some theaters in South America, so in the Americas, they took in $237 million at their own private branded, PLF theaters.
Premium large format. So that's a, in those particular screens in their theater, the ones that are large format and they charge extra for, they took in $237 million,
right.
A 30% increase over the year earlier, which partially is due to the fact that they added more premium large format screens.
Right. It's a little misleading to say we went up. Well, okay, you also added a whole bunch of theaters.
So here's what the New York Times said. 5 years ago, the chains led by Cinemark started using off-the-shelf digital technology to build their own large format theaters, which they operate under a grab bag of brands, including Big D, ETX, Prime, RPX, Ultra AVX, and XD. Just as with IMAX, moviegoers pay a premium to watch movies in these auditoriums. Unlike with IMAX, the chains do not have to share revenue with a nugget or exhibitor, end quote. And they're, of course, referring to IMAX. They don't got to give a cut to IMAX. They get to, you know, they have to split it with the studio, whatever their split is. But they don't also then have to pay someone else.
Yeah,
and
actually,
they're like, yay. And IMAX says, how dare you?
Well,
you're ripping off the IMAX brand. And that's our job. We're the ones who create the IMAX screen and IMAX technology and have now ripped it off by creating faux IMAX that is not IMAX screens at all, but we still charge you a premium for it. We have hundreds of those all over the country. We're the ones who rip off our own technology. We're the ones who rip off our brand name and pretend it's an IMAX screen when it's really not. How dare you do the same thing?
Right. So how do you really feel about this, Michael? I agree. I think we called it FIMAX or LIMAX at one point, where it's these screens that are not IMAX auditoriums. They're kind of retrofitted to small, you know, be smaller. So in a way, IMAX actually showed all of these different theater chains how to go about it.
Yeah.
And when, you know, IMAX was around, they were the only ones that could do what IMAX did, because they were these big, huge, monstrous projectors with 65-millimeter film prints that were, you know, cost $25,000. It was expensive.
Well, they're not doing IMAX. It's not this format. It's
It's
just a nice movie theater that they charge more for.
Right.
It's their nicest screen, and they say you're going to pay extra.
And
anybody who pays it is an idiot. Don't do it. It's a ripoff.
And that's where I'm headed with this, is that effectively, with digital technology and digital projection, IMAX, you know, basically converted over to that as well. And it was also, you know, all these exhibitors were also able to do the exact same thing using, at times, almost identical equipment.
But again, this is not IMAX we're talking about. The screens at IMAX brands, we're not talking about IMAX and that large print thing. We're just talking about, it's a nice theater. They could have done this 40 years ago and said, if you want to sit in the nicest theater in our auditorium, we've got four screens and one of them is bigger. It seats 800 people. The other seat 300. You want to sit in the nice theater with 800 people, you're going to pay extra. That's all this is.
Part of the reason the exhibitors want to do this is because
they make more money.
Well, and IMAX takes a cut. So when you pay...
They just want to make more money. They're not trying to screw IMAX. They're trying to make more money. They're trying to screw the customer.
Well, I don't necessarily... Well, yeah, I mean...
Yes, of course they are. They're saying, oh, if we can convince you to pay more money to sit in this room rather than that room, it's the same movie, it's the same technology, it's even got the same stadium seating, there's no difference. None.
Well, here's the thing.
We're going to charge you more if in room A rather than room B because it says RPX. There's no difference to what you're seeing.
Well, now, and you proved the point earlier in our discussion here, Michael, by being confused as to, I don't know, whether was it ETX or RPX? There was an X in it. I don't know. Was it Ultra AVX?
It's very simple. There will be a surcharge. They will charge you extra.
But you didn't
know. That's when you know you're getting ripped off.
You didn't know the brand.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter. Nobody cares what the brand name is. They're just saying, this is our big screen, you're going to pay extra. You want to go into this theater, you pay extra money.
I'm talking about the business
now. Nobody cares what the logo
is. I'm talking about the business now. The exhibitors are trying to brand themselves, and it's actually becoming confusing.
It's not confusing. You pay extra. You want to see it in 3D, you pay extra. You want to see it on this screen, you're going to pay extra. It doesn't matter what the logos are. Nobody cares. Cinemark calls it, what Regal calls their premium screen. It doesn't matter. But you'll know when you buy the ticket because it costs more.
Well, I think IMAX will actually become like Kleenex, which is not, you know, it's...
But it's not IMAX. Most of the IMAX screens are just the same as these guys.
I'm talking about from a branding and marketing perspective.
But the brand is a lie. IMAX is not providing some unique technological experience like they originally did. The original thing of IMAX was like 3D versus 2D. It was a unique experience that you could not see unless you went to an IMAX theater. That is no longer true. There's IMAX screens all over the country that are just fake. They're just regular movie screens. And anybody paying for that, that lie, you're like, oh, it's the IMAX brand. It's not. It's the IMAX lie. They're ripping people off. And anybody who pays for it is an idiot.
Okay, now that you've called all of our listeners idiots.
Well, they don't go normally. They're too smart.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. It's obvious why exhibitors, movie theater owners, theater operators would want to brand them their own, you know, version
why
of this.
Why they want to charge more for a ticket? And yes,
right.
It is
why
obvious.
Do you think studios would be helping build up these networks of premium large format theaters? Why do you think they would do that? Partly because
the more money that the theater takes in, the more of a cut they get.
That's right.
Right. If they were, they'd like ticket prices to be $20.
If IMAX wasn't skimming off the top, they get more money. But also, this is a way to sell a product at a higher price, as you just mentioned, Michael.
So, that's the only purpose of it.
Right now, there are a number of IMAX slots. I'll call them IMAX slots because they're being released through IMAX. IMAX basically, you know, runs...
It's a limited supply. Right. They only run movies for about 2 weeks, and they only have a handful of films that they can fit in because they don't have that many screens. So if you've got The Amazing Spider-Man 2, you're only going to get a two-week run probably, and then another movie is going to bump you off. And so they want more screens where they can charge more money. That's why they've been pushing for 3D, so everyone can charge more money and make a bigger cut. That's why they're pushing for these large format screens. It's just to make more money. And people need to rebel and not be, as they're rebelling against 3D, they need to rebel against paying a premium price to sit in a theater and watch a movie and pay more to be in room A rather than room B when it's the exact same experience. Don't get suckered into it. And don't get suckered into paying big prices to go to Coachella, because you'll have a lot more fun in the masses of people on the floor than in the VIP tent. Isn't that true, Sperling?
That I would agree with. I mean, I've been in both the VIP tents and the VIP areas and the, you know, with the hoi polloi, you know, also out on the field. And it's been fine.
The hoi polloi is on the field.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
The hoi polloi means the masses. So when did Coachella take place?
Coachella took place, well, here's the thing. Every year it takes place in April. It used to be over one weekend, two days, Saturday and Sunday. Now it's two weekends, identical sets, identical artists, identical bills, or identical lineups, as they call them. And it took place this past weekend, the first weekend.
And for a long time. So there's another one this weekend.
Next weekend, same exact artists.
Cool. And you can watch it on YouTube, right?
Not anymore.
Oh, only the first weekend?
Only the first weekend and only live for a limited time. Now, Michael, as you know, I've been going to Coachella since 1999. This is the first year that I did not go.
You're old.
I started when I was one.
Yeah. Well, and of course, for years, they've had premium tickets and VIP tents and other stuff, but it's sort of starting to change the culture and vibe of the festival. I mean, acts are even talking about it on stage. What's going on?
So, you know, the VIP areas used to be off to the side. You know, they weren't necessarily all that great, frankly, and they weren't much more expensive. They were maybe $100, $200 more expensive, $300 more expensive. Frankly, going to these shows is expensive. It was $275, $300, $325. Now it's $375, which is one of the most expensive festival tickets in North America. It is one of the, as I mentioned, premier festivals in North America, mainly because of its location. It is very close to Hollywood. It's about 2 hours outside of Los Angeles, in the desert, in the Mojave Desert, or at least on the edge of it.
What's happening to the premium venues? They used to be on the side. Are they now blocking the front five rows off for VIPs?
Well,
or what's
what they
happening?
Do is they kind of split the front of the stage in half, and half is for the
seating. You mean the seating?
There's no seating. It's all, you know.
Well, you said the front of the stage. You don't mean the stage. You mean where the people are.
Yes, correct. The standing. Yeah. And if you have certain tickets, you could just walk right up. You just walk right. You know, you don't have to sit there all day waiting for that one band that you just can't wait to see.
How do you even get there? I mean, how can you push through the crowd to get there?
They actually have specific access for some of these VIP tickets. And, you know, now they have, I guess this year, the straight up VIP pass costs $800. That's just, you know, for the ticket. And that gives you, like, you get a special cocktail bar, and there's...
Which you have to pay for.
Yeah, well, yeah, by the way, you have to pay for the drinks. It basically just gets you into that area. And
you can pay more, right? You can buy a gourmet food for, like, $1,000.
Right, there was, like, a little package of, you know, chefs that came in and like would cook a gourmet, four-course gourmet dinner for you. And I'm thinking, aren't you supposed to actually be watching the music?
You know, no, you can fly in by private jet if you want to, right?
That's right. One of the packages had a private jet. And quite honestly, the reason, and I've mentioned it previously on the show, the reason I didn't go this year, well, there's more than a few of them, but the tickets went on sale last year in May. That's a month after the festival ended. So, like 11 months ago, tickets went on sale. The lineup was far from being announced, and it went on sale while I was actually traveling back from Cannes, and so I couldn't get tickets.
You're really not going to win a lot of sympathy by saying, I was in the Swiss Alps when the tickets went on sale.
Right, they went on during the Cannes Film Festival. Right.
So I don't care. I don't care if they're VIPs. I don't care what they pay for their access. Long as they're off in their own little world, because normally they don't care about the show anyway. If you go to a rock venue like Madison Square Garden, they've got the sky boxes where the VIPs are. They're in the luxury boxes. They're up in the roof. And you know what? They're not watching the concert. They're chatting and talking and drinking and eating and whatever. And who cares? They're not in our way. They're up there in the sky, glancing down when they want to, having their fun and doing their business deals. Nobody cares. The problem is when they interfere with our enjoyment of the show, when the people who line up and get there early and camp out to see their favorite act find that a lot of their access is restricted because there's VIP areas right there on the floor.
That's right.
New, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it started last year, and the year before that, it started to creep in. And so these VIP areas are beginning to creep in. And quite honestly, when I tried to buy tickets back in January, the only tickets available for this first weekend was for the safari tent, quote unquote. It cost $6,500.
Ouch. Well, yeah, then you're not going to do that, obviously. And if they should have the VIP area up on a riser in the back behind the crowd. So you can be there on the side on a slightly raised thing. So they're there. They can see over the crowd towards the stage, but they're not blocking anybody. Everybody be happy. Nobody would care.
Yeah, well, you know, part of the issue is, as Gary Bongiovanni, who is the editor of Polestar, a concert
industry. He sounds like a rock band.
Yeah, he's very well known, actually, in the concert industry. He runs Polestar, that it's an industry trade magazine for the concert industry. Uh-huh. He says, it doesn't matter who the artist is on stage, because it's really, Coachella has started to become all about these little special accoutrements, and a lot of those accoutrements are now off-site. I mean, as it is, the Empire Polo Field, it's huge. Coachella is enormous. There's 5, 6, 7 stages. But at the end of the day, there's also all of these parties and these special events going on nearby that are pulling.
Well, it's like Sundance or something else where it becomes really successful, and then suddenly you've got Chrysler with a tent promoting their new car.
That's exactly what's happening.
Right. That's fine. Because if you don't care about that, you can just go to the movies. It doesn't interfere with you watching the movie. The problem is when the tent is there in the theater blocking the screen.
Right. And in this case, there's no place for any of these corporations who are trying to come in and do this kind of like guerrilla or ambush marketing. There's no place for them to do that. Although these parties, people go out to Coachella, they never actually get to the Empire Polo Field because I got so many invitations to all of these different houses and
well, none of that's got to do with the show.
No, none of it has
right.
anything
none of
it
has
with
to do
show.
With Coachella. It's no. just, you know, whatever. So if you care about that stuff, fine, knock yourself out. Who cares? But the problem is when they interfere with the show itself.
Yes, and I don't think, you know.
So who complained? Didn't some acts actually complain and run it down?
Actually, Arcade Fire, which has performed at Coachella in 2005, 2007, a couple years ago again, and this is, I think, their fourth time performing there. They actually said, hey, you know, Wynn Butler, the lead singer, said, I know that everybody is always trying to get into these VIP areas, and it's become a big deal this year. But you know what? I'm here to tell you, it actually sucks in there, okay? And this is where the action's at, out here on the field. And he was saying that in closing the event because they were the headliner on Sunday night.
Wow, but that's rock and roll. You're not going to be a rock and roll guy and say, you all should be in the VIP section. They got some great champagne.
Backstage is way better, man. I don't know what you're doing out front.
Yeah, so you didn't go, but you did watch it on YouTube. Now, YouTube has been an online site where people have had live concerts and live events. I've never watched anything on YouTube. And of course, it would depend on who's doing that event and how they present it. What was the experience like watching Coachella on YouTube since you've been there and you know what it's like to be there live?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, in 2008, I tried to watch the Rose Bowl performance of U2 on YouTube. And it worked for a while.
The Rose Bowl?
Yeah, they played the Rose Bowl and it was...
Oh, you mean it was just a regular concert?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, after a while, I was like, wow, I'm watching it on this small little laptop screen because I was traveling at the
time. Well, you could have streamed it to your TV or something, right?
Well, yeah, I was traveling at the time, so I couldn't. But now, with you know, all of these different streaming sticks and Rokus and Chrome Play, you know, all these different technologies, I thought, you know what, rather than go this year and have to, you know, I'm not the tallest guy in the world, okay? So
what? No, you're a giant among men. Well, so you're
on stature,
you're
only.
You're shortish.
Ish, yeah. More on the ish side. But, you know, so standing amidst 80,000 of my fellow friends trying to see over them, I realized, you know what? I'm actually watching the screen most of the time anyway. So why don't I see, since there was this big deal last year about the streaming of Coachella on YouTube, why don't I see what that's like? And because I know the venues, and you're right, Michael, it did help to know where kind of the geography and know where the shots, what the shots were shooting and where people were and what stages they were on. That really helped. I don't know whether seeing, you know, another festival that I was less familiar with would be as good, but boy, did they do a really good job this year. For the most part, there were some moments.
Now, most live concerts cut. They edit and edit and edit. Every 5 seconds, they're cutting to another camera. Was that notable here? Or were they notably not doing that? Or what was so well done about it?
Well, you know, in the beginning of each day, you pretty much just get whoever's on camera that day. And, the technical directors are, you know, they're not familiar with the bands. They're, you know, less well-known bands. And so
you're saying the cameras are operated by just standard tech people. But later in the day, that changes. It's not just whatever union guy is placed on that camera.
Right. You actually get the camera operators who travel with these acts, so they know.
So someone who travels with Arcade Fire is suddenly in control of the camera and knows what to do.
Right, and is there helping switch, you know, play technical director and knows which camera to take and when, because they know where the artists will be.
Well, we tried to find out who actually directed some of these venues at Coachella, but weren't able to find it out. But they did a good job, according to Sperling. And one of your predictions came through, right? Because last year in March, you saw Churches in a tiny little club and made a prediction. What did you say?
I said, you know, I turned to the record executive, the record label executives that I was sitting near, and I said, mark my words, next year, this band, Churches, will be at Coachella. They will be playing the sunset time slot on Saturday. I was off by 3 hours.
Ah, so close. And how did you watch their set on YouTube?
Yes, and it was quite good. I think that they were kind of hampered by A, it was really bright and sunny. B, it was very windy, and there was a sandstorm that kind of cropped up. But here's what I found fascinating. They were on what's called the outdoor stage. That is the exact same stage that Vampire Weekend played shortly before their album was released, way back, I want to say it was 2008 or 9. I think it was 2008. And they had become a huge buzz band, much like Churches, and everybody was showing up to see whether they were the real deal. By the end, they had won everybody over. Churches, the exact same thing. And, you know, I've seen them a couple times before, and I knew that they would win people over. And it's very interesting to see a band like that on the rise. Now, speaking of bands on the rise, that same stage right afterwards was Capital Cities. They did a great job. A band I was not familiar with was, and now, thanks to seeing them on YouTube and Coachella, I'm going to look them up and pay more attention to them. They did a great job and really got the crowd going, as did Churches. But then came an act that this time last year, nobody knew about. Much like Churches, nobody knew who Lorde was. In fact, she had only written the song Royals. Well,
you did. You tried to buy a ticket to that show and couldn't even get one.
That was in September.
Ah, okay.
And so she booked Coachella. This gives you some insight into how this business works. She booked Coachella in May of last year.
Well, more to the point, they booked her.
They booked her, right.
They smartly booked her.
Right. Now, that doesn't...
I mean, she'd be happy to play the festival, but they plucked her out of obscurity, practically.
Right. And at that point, Royals was not charting, wasn't really known. She probably was, in their minds, going to be playing at noon. Instead, she played right after sundown. And what's interesting about Coachella, more than Lollapalooza, more than Austin City Limits, more than Bonnaroo even, is that it has become a place, it has become an event where a great performance becomes, it can help propel your career in a completely different direction. It happened for Arcade Fire in 2005. They played some side stage. Nobody really knew who they were. They put on a show, and the next thing you know, they are the biggest thing in indie rock.
And to clarify, Lorde had a number one hit in New Zealand in March of 2013. So she was a number one pop singer already in one part of the world. So this was not exactly like, oh, who's this crazy kid? You know, she'd had a big success in her home country. Obviously, New Zealand doesn't necessarily translate to worldwide fame, but there you go. So you got a sense of the buzz from watching it on YouTube. That's kind of interesting.
And I also had Twitter going and Instagram. But the problem is, of course, that the cell coverage at these events, no matter what festival it is horrific. So you're getting like updates.
Why do you care? You weren't there.
No, what I mean is you're getting updates from like, oh, look, they're talking about something that happened 3 hours ago. But they sent it 3 hours ago. But I have to say, if you can go onto YouTube, look for Lorde's performance at Coachella this year. She came out just herself and two backups. A phenomenal job. She basically could have completely tanked. And you know, she's 16 years old. It's a lot of pressure to put on a very young person. And she totally, that was one of the best performances I saw. And I must say, Michael, normally I'll go to Coachella, I'll see about 5-6 acts a day, 7 if I'm lucky. Because I was able to bounce around from stage to stage faster, and when one stage was down, I could go to another stage quicker, I saw probably 50-60 acts.
And next year, they'll have YouTube Premium, where you can pay a fee and see even more acts and watch them whenever you want and choose the camera angle.
You know what? I don't doubt it. And by watching it on YouTube, I don't mean on a little tiny postage size stamp. I had it blown up HD just to see if it would work. And it totally worked. I mean, there were times where it got a little pixelated, but for the most part, it was a crisp, clear picture with stereo. So the equipment at home is getting better. The ability to get it into our homes live over the internet and not through cable is getting way better. So that's really what we're discussing here. That's really why we're talking about this. But after Lorde came Pharrell Williams. Of course, he's very popular now. He's got that big song, Happy, which please don't start singing it because it won't get out of my head for the rest of the day. And also Get Lucky with Daft Punk. However, by then, and I started noticing this, and this is what I mean by I'm familiar with the venues, so I kind of knew, hey, that shot, how come I can't see the Ferris wheel? Why all of a sudden is everything red and I can't see 5 feet in front of the stage? Where'd the crowd go? There was a huge dust storm. And Pharrell Williams could barely sing at the end. And you could hear...
Well, the weather was bad for his performance. And he's not a good live performer anyway. He's mostly a producer.
Yes.
You know, he's doing a couple shows, but he's not really a live performer. That's why he's doing The Voice. He's not suddenly turning into a recording artist who wants to have big success on his own. It's happened. He's had a hit single, but he's not really a draw live, and he didn't do a great job.
No, he did not.
Well, so Lorde's performance was a big deal. Pharrell Williams' performance was a big whoop.
Well, I think it was a big deal for Pharrell, and whether he, you know...
It's a big whoop. He didn't do well.
Right, but like I said, performances at venues and events like Coachella can help make your career.
Right, and it was a big whoop because it didn't help his career.
Oh, you know, I see what you're doing here. I think I see what you're doing. You're trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, right? That's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, our first story, well, it's about China, because China famously has a quota on foreign films. We talk about it quite a lot here. You know, and by foreign films, let's face it, what we're really talking about is Hollywood blockbusters. Only 34 movies are allowed to be distributed in the country each year. Plus, there's just one official distributor that Hollywood can negotiate with, and even that doesn't guarantee their movies will make it past the Chinese censors. And at best, they'll get, what, like 25% of the box office takeout, anybody releasing a film in China? So all that could be changing now. The trade papers, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Deadline, they're all reporting that the quota will be raised to 44 films, though the extra 10 films will apparently be more like art movies and thus really not a threat to the Chinese-made films at the box office. Word is out that a second distributor has been approved, which I think is actually confirmed, though the government... Oh, no, apparently not. The government has denied it so far. You're right here, Michael. And with two distributors competing, which I think they're going to have to do, with both of these distributors competing for business and more movies coming in, it's just possible, might be possible, that Hollywood will have some leverage to get a bigger cut of the box office, although I doubt it. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. Things are changing. More movies, even art films, is important because sometimes an art film turns out to be a big hit. You know, a French film might not seem like a big blockbuster, but it can become hugely popular. Look at The Untouchables. So, you know, they think maybe they're pulling in some art films, but you never know where a hit's going to come from. And more distributors means more competition, which means better terms for the guy that they're competing for. When you want the next Avatar, what are you going to offer them? What do they have to offer except a bigger cut of the box office? I don't know why you don't think it'll help. You know, if this company's trying to beat out that company, what else can they offer except 30% of the box office rather than 25%? You've got commercial business, money to be made. You got a middle class that wants to see all the big movies. They want to see more films. They're tired of only seeing movies on bootleg or only reading about them. And that's going to change. And that's going to help bring more movies into the market and make the movie market in China more open and democratic.
Well, you know, maybe they could actually watch it on YouTube like I did.
That's, well, not illegal ones.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. But I have to say, just to finish off the Coachella thing, I did not think it would feel like actually being there. And there were moments that really did capture it.
That's cool. Well, like a great live TV performance can. You can see someone on a venue like Letterman, and it can be really, you know, powerful.
Oh, well, speaking of Letterman, since, you know, we did last week, and we immediately said, hey, Vince Vaughn should take over. We thought that would be a great idea. Well, it didn't really take too long for them to figure this out. Stephen Colbert has had his eye on Letterman for years. It's no coincidence his contracts were timed to end whenever Letterman had a contract up for renewal. CBS entered serious negotiations with Colbert and Colbert alone and signed him to a 5-year deal where the comic will get to dump his right-wing persona and be himself as a late-night host. It was greeted with acclaim by industry papers, who we keep referring to as industry papers, apparently. They all pointed out that Colbert will help CBS get young viewers in late night and compete directly against what we like to call the Jimmies, Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel, in a way that few other names could immediately do. There is no word yet on whether he'll be asked by CBS to legally change his name to Jimmy Colbert, which may actually happen. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. Everybody wanted to know what was going to happen. Would there be a minority? Would there be a person of color? Would it be a woman? Would it be a black woman? Nope, it's another white male. So it's sort of boring. It is the first name that sprang to everybody's mind. They knew he's wanted to do this for years. What I found fascinating was Craig Ferguson. Apparently now we get little bits and pieces of information. His relationship with Worldwide Pants, the company that Letterman's owned, that's been cool for a few years. His relations with CBS, not good. This came up, Letterman retired. Not one person said Craig Ferguson was even remotely considered. They didn't even pretend that they were considering him. They're like, no, that's not happening. So that, to me, is the most interesting thing. Whether he'll keep on for another year or two after Letterman's gone and there'll be a transition period and then he'll go or whatever, I don't know. But clearly, he is not one that's beloved by CBS.
Well, and we've talked about this before, Michael. Both you and I love him.
Oh, yeah, I think he's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good show and well
worth watching. Yeah, I was never a fan of Conan O'Brien particularly. I know he's still there on TBS. There's another thing. Nobody talked about, well, what happened to people who didn't make it onto the big slot? Like, Conan O'Brien has disappeared off the radar.
I agree. I mean, when he decided, Conan O'Brien, that is, he left the Tonight Show.
He didn't decide. He was kicked out.
Well, yeah, he left the Tonight Show. But when he decided that he would be going to cable rather than a broadcast network, everybody said,
He didn't have many choices. Well, I don't know that he decided. He that was his only option, really.
Well, Fox was talking about a show with him, but I think everybody felt like, well, look, it works for Jon Stewart, it works for Stephen Colbert, so it could work. It could work. It's not working, I don't think. Nobody talks about it. It's like
I don't know what the ratings are.
I don't know what the ratings are. I don't know who's on it. I don't know what's happening with that show. I do know that they will be in Comic-Con next year, in 2015. They're going to actually shoot the show from Comic-Con.
Well, that's a reasonable tie-in, you know?
Yeah, which assumes that he'll still be on the air in 2015, actually.
Well, he will be.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know what his deal is, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now, the reason this is in Big Deal, Big Whoop, this whole story about Stephen Colbert and Letterman, is because it happened so early in the week, last week, that it just didn't seem right to spend a whole lot of time talking about it since everybody's talked about it to death. What I would like to do is start a new trend about discussing and debating who will take over for Stephen Colbert.
That's about what they do. By the way, Conan O'Brien had just extended his contract through 2015, November. So that happened in April of this year.
Okay. And so therefore he will not be taking over for Stephen Colbert?
Apparently not.
Okay. Now we got shut out of the Letterman job. Okay. But now we've got somebody off the table. Colbert is gone, right? Who else?
And like we said at the time, Comedy Central is the big loser. Oh, that's what I said in my Twitter account. I'm sorry. I mean, Comedy Central lost Stephen Colbert to David Letterman, and they lost John Oliver because they had nowhere to offer him a slot. He went to HBO because Comedy Central had nowhere to put him. That's one reason why he chose to go to HBO. If this had happened earlier and Colbert was going to transition to Letterman and they'd had John Oliver and he hadn't made a jump yet, he would be the guy taking over for the slot after Jon Stewart. Now they lose both of them. They lose the most popular guy in Jon Stewart and they lose Stephen Colbert. It's a really big blow to Comedy Central.
It is. And I don't necessarily know who they could get. Maybe Wyatt Cenac or, I mean...
There's all the people on Stewart that you would look at as possible people to go into that slot, of course.
Yeah, I don't know who they're going to get. But, you know, whoever they get, they better pay him. Because I know, especially, I mean, if you look at, like, Les Moonves, he's part of CBS, which is part of Viacom, right?
He's barely making it by.
Yeah, I mean, we were really worried about him. But now we can heave a huge sigh of relief because, frankly, as I mentioned, we were a little concerned about Les. As I like to call him. He's the head of CBS, as I just mentioned. New salary information, or should we say compensation figure, since nobody seems to call it a salary anymore, lest it actually be what it is. They have just been released, and Les Moonves got $66.9 million in 2013. Now, here's my question. Couldn't they have just tossed in an extra $100,000 and made it, like, an even $67 million, or would that have,
Come on. Between friends, what's an extra $100,000?
I think, you know what it is? He would have hit the alternative minimum tax if he got that.
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Their stock rose 69%, outpacing the 30% rise in the Standard & Poor's 500, the S&P 500. So, you know, in other exec payday news, the head of NBC Universal, who I'm assuming is Ron Meyer, by the way, he made $31 million, a nearly $5 million raise. And I guess that $5 million is for sticking around during all the turmoil over the past year. And the head of Comcast, which, of course, owns NBC Universal, also made $31 million, though he only got a measly raise of less than $2 million. Maybe next year, if they merge with Time Warner Cable, he'll do better. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop.
No.
You know, what can you do? It's absurd that a publicly traded company would pay that much money, but as they would all argue, well, you can't get good help for less than $30 million.
Yeah, well, I'll do it for $29.
Yeah, how could they possibly find someone to run a big company for less than $32 million? It's crazy. It wouldn't happen. They would turn it down.
Well, you know, something funny, actually, here in Los Angeles, I was driving down the 101, and I drove past what is now Comcast NBC Universal. And the big building there in Studio City, or Universal City, which they have this big building, it used to say Universal Studios or Universal Pictures, and it was, like, a stretched across the whole top of the building, you know, 40 stories tall. It's, like, the tallest building in the San Fernando Valley. And then they merged with NBC, so it kind of said NBC Universal, and you know, spacing was getting kind of tight. Now it says Comcast NBC Universal. They could barely stick all these letters on.
Ridiculous. They should have just that little thing that you're supposed to scan to take you to a web page. So if you want to read the full name, just put that little squiggly thing. What's that called?
The QR code?
Yeah, just put the QR code up there, and then people could scan it and see what the full name is.
Yeah. It's funny. Well, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and, you know, this is what, that's the group that normal people would call the Academy of Movies. You know, they have this little event each year. They give out these shiny objects.
Keep going.
Okay, well, they're going full steam ahead on their movie museum. But they've never really aggressively pursued donations and acquisitions of movie memorabilia, although I kind of take umbrage with that, Michael. Not personal offense, but I would have to correct you. They do actually collect.
No, only they've started in the last two or three years, very few, very recently, very nominal. They barely have anything.
They have film prints. They've been collecting tons of film prints. In fact, in their Hollywood office, they have a vault, which I've been in.
I was talking about movie memorabilia. You're going to have a museum, it's not film prints. It's going to be Dorothy's slippers, which they have, and it's going to be the rosebud and other stuff like that.
Yeah,
yes,
no, they don't
have any of
that.
Film prints are incredibly important too, but they also do not have the things that you walk through a museum and look at.
They have lots of the marketing material, so a lot of posters, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, they want their museum there to be serious, right? Then people are questioning whether it will be a serious venue with art world credibility or just like a tourist attraction like Madame Tussauds. The Academy hopes they've made an impact by hiring the Smithsonian curator, Carrie Brower, to become the head of the Academy Museum. Not only is Brower a significant figure in the world of museums, he's made his bones, get it? He's made his bones because you see bones are actually in the Natural History Museum. You see what we did there?
No.
Okay. I thought that's what you were doing. You wrote this.
It's just an expression. Oh. I wasn't trying to reference types of museums.
Okay. Well, apparently Brouwer made his bones with major exhibits that focus on movies, such as Notorious, Alfred Hitchcock, and Contemporary Art. That was the name of that exhibit. That was at Oxford, actually. And the Cinema Effect, Illusion, Reality, and the Moving Image. Does every exhibit need to have a colon in it? I guess it does. That last exhibit was at the Smithsonian Hirshhorn in D.C. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a serious get. He's a serious museum figure, and it shows that they hopefully have a serious intent to make this not just some little Madame Tussauds, but a real major museum that treats films with the seriousness it deserves.
Well, now, I love this next story because much like us talking about Coachella via YouTube and what that means business-wise, this next one, there's kind of like an undertone of how this business works, okay? That's the broadcast business, the cable business, and the, you know, retransmission agreement business. The Weather Channel, you might recall they were dropped from DirecTV. Well, they're back on DirecTV now. They were in a dispute because DirecTV objected to the channel's programming, saying the Weather Channel was airing 40% reality programming, like Coast Guard, Alaska, and Lifeguard. Are those actual shows, Michael?
Yes.
Okay. Well, they were airing those instead of, you know, like, I don't know, weather reports, which is what they're known for. The Weather Channel agreed to cut back on afternoon reruns of reality shows, add in instant weather, local weather, and make its services available to go on multiple devices for subscribers. But what must have really hurt was the way the Weather Channel had to get on its knees and beg forgiveness. This is their public statement from CEO David Kenny, who said, "Our apologies to DirecTV and their customers for the disruption of our service and for initiating a public campaign. Our viewers deserve better than a public dispute, and we pledge to reward their loyalty with exceptional programming and more weather-focused news." Now, this agreement puts the Weather Channel back on DirecTV's 20 million homes. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, 20 million homes, they only reach 100 million. So if you lose 20% of all the homes you're in, that hurts. And they get an average of 13 cents a month per subscriber from all their pay TV people. And they wanted to raise their fee one penny. I don't know if they got that penny, but they sure had to eat crow. And, you know, that those pennies add up. That's $30 million a year they get from DirecTV. So, you know, that's serious money. So, and that blackout is one reason they invested all this money in Sam Champion coming from Good Morning America and then a big ad campaign to launch his presence on the Weather Channel. And it was a flop because they were missing 20% of their homes. So it's really hurt them. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens long term. But at least they're back on DirecTV now.
Well, and it just, what I was referring to earlier by kind of, you see the inner workings here, the unspoken inner workings. Basically, part of this deal in which DirecTV said, okay, fine, if you do all of this stuff with your programming, we'll take you back at 13 cents per subscriber per month. Part of that deal was, oh, and by the way, our subscribers are getting pissed off at us, DirecTV, for all of these retransmission disputes. We want you to publicly apologize for turning this into a big deal.
Right.
So that was kind of one of those little contract points. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also, you know, hey, you're supposed to be the Weather Channel. Why am I turning on the Weather Channel and seeing reruns of reality shows? It's not even weather reality shows. I guess Coast Guard Alaska, maybe. But, you know, it just seems silly.
Don't you mean Coast Guard Alaska?
Something like that. Moving on.
Okay. Well, the big news is that more money was spent on ads online than on network TV. And I know Michael loves this story because it's filled with numbers.
Yay!
The bigger picture is that companies spend a lot of money on ads. And I mean a lot of money on ads. Maybe you didn't hear me. They spend a lot of money on ads. Broadcast TV ads hit $40.1 billion. Online advertising, that's all advertising in the digital and mobile realm, hit $42.8 billion.
That's more.
But don't forget cable TV. That generated another $34.4 billion. So overall, TV advertising on broadcast and cable outlets reached $74.5 billion. Take that, YouTube! Although, please don't take that, because that was like the only way I saw Coachella this year. So if you could not take it or take it, but then leave us with, you know, really good programming, that would really help. Anyway, search ads alone. Yes, we're looking at you, Google, owner of YouTube. they hit $18.4 billion. Now, you might recall the online ads hit $42.8 billion, right? So the $18.4 billion that Google is taking in search advertising is 43% of the entire online ad market. You know what? Where should I go to look up info about the online ad market, Michael? Where do you think I should go?
Google!
Oh, good idea. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal. But yeah. What's fascinating to me, beyond the growth, is how so much money is still concentrated in just a few players. You look at cable and the hundreds of channels and all the great programming, and the majority of the money still goes to the big five.
Yep.
ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and the CW. That's amazing, especially when you think how much money goes to ESPN. There's not a lot of money left over for, I don't know, the Learning Channel.
No.
I'm sure they're profitable. Don't call us. Same thing with online. Wow. Almost half the market is just Google and I suppose AOL and whatever some other sites are that are search. But most of that is Google. All the hundreds of thousands or millions of websites, and most of the money is going to one website alone.
Well, first off, I would say please do call us, 888-567-7263.
And take out an ad. Buy an ad on our show.
Yes, especially if you're an advertiser or a sponsor. Yeah, you know, this has been true since day one of the internet. You had Yahoo, Google. There were always like 10 websites that were sucking up most of the advertising revenue. It's gotten a lot more equal, so it's actually fallen a bit for these websites. But still, it's mostly, you know, a handful of players making most of the money.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But Sprun, before we move on to the next big deal, big whoop, I just want to say that I'd like to have more Ovaltine, please, because Ovaltine is a chocolatey, delicious drink that I enjoy while I listen to Showbiz Sandbox. More Ovaltine, please. Available at your local supermarket.
Did you just, like, get a decoder ring in the mail or something? I don't.
I'm just showing people what it'd be like if we had ads.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Sony is laying off some of its risk. Talking about money. 1 year after they suffered a series of high-profile flops, Sony has entered a debt and equity deal. It's basically, hey, you're going to buy into our company and we're going to take a giant loan from you. This deal is with L Star Capital and Citibank. It amounts to $200 million. It's a multi-year deal strictly limited to the company's movie slate, so it's slate financing. So these are movies like The Amazing Spider-Man 2. I don't know how it could possibly cover that film since the movie's about to be released, and 22 Jump Street. Both of these movies are about to be released. How could you're back financing? Anyway, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's a $200 million deal.
I agree.
What is the point? So they get to make one movie for free, and they're going to let somebody else get cuts on all the profits and all their films just so they can make one extra movie? I mean, Spidey alone cost $200 million before marketing. So it doesn't even cost the amount of making and releasing Spider-Man 2, but you're going to give them a cut of all these films. I don't understand it.
Well, this is now common practice in Hollywood for studios to say, rather than do what they used to do, which is they would take North America and maybe Europe and then sell off the rights to all the other territories.
Right.
What they're doing now is saying, we'll take the entire world, please, since that is actually really valuable and we're making more money internationally than here at home.
Or just take international. Yeah.
Right. They want to keep those rights. But they also want to hedge. They want to say, well, you know, if we don't do that well, we don't want to be the only one sinking in this ship. So what do we do? Well,
I don't know what the deal is, so I can't really comment on the efficacy of it and how smart it is for them and or the investors. Because in the old days, whenever you do slate stuff, the investors ended up getting screwed. You know, the big movies would not turn in as much profit as you want, and the little movies always had more of a loss than you expected.
Right,
and but you ended up nominal amount of money for all the money you invested. You know.
Right, but then you had Relativity come in, and for instance, they did a deal with Sony, and Legendary Pictures as well is doing the same thing. These are slate financing deals with no cherry picking allowed, meaning
right,
we get to finance Superman, we get to finance The Dark Knight, oh, and we get to finance this other thing that may or may not be a big hit. It could tank and we'll lose all of our money. Now, the deal with Relativity that Sony had ended in 2011. It was for $500 million. And really what this is saying, it just goes to show you what kind of dire straits Sony Pictures is in, unfortunately, because L Street Capital, or L Star Capital, is the financing arm, the credit financing, meaning loan, of Lone Star Funds. And that is a Texas firm that is mostly focused on real estate, but really what they do is they buy distressed assets.
They're not selling off distressed assets. They're just taking money wherever they can. If it's Arab people who want to invest in the movies, or it's little investors who pool their money, or it's people from China, wherever the new money comes to town, every Hollywood studio will gladly take your money to invest in movies and enjoy yourself on your way out.
Right. What I'm saying is if Sony was interested in this, they could get money for these types of films from any credit facility. However, it is the distressed the company that focuses on distressed assets that actually is interested.
Well, yeah, I don't get it. If you don't have confidence in your movie and don't want to release it worldwide, don't make it.
Ooh.
Okay. You balance the risk by making different types of movies. You make Spidey 2 and you make that. But all you're doing is letting someone else get some of your profits. It never made any sense to me.
Well, this is a trend that has been going on for some time now in Hollywood, and maybe it will end. But that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And frankly, that last story could have been an Inside Baseball, but since it's tax time here in the U.S., and Canada actually is shortly behind us, I think May 5th is their tax day, you know what? We thought, let's do some tax stories, because there's always stories about some producer or some production that's looking to not pay taxes with all these tax credits that every single state in the U.S. seems to be giving movies and television shows and theater productions. There's a story in the New York Times a week or so ago about, I guess, tax credits being offered by the state of New York to encourage theater productions to move upstate and to prep for their national tour. So if they have to rehearse, or they have to hold casting sessions, or
build sets. Yeah, you know, they build sets and all that stuff. Yeah,
yeah. They basically prep the entire show, set it up, do the tech rehearsals, do all of this work in other venues outside of Broadway, because of course the theaters on Broadway, A, are expensive, and B, they're being used.
Well, they don't do it on Broadway. No, they normally would do it in the first town that they were launching the tour. So if they were opening in Chicago, they would do it in Chicago.
Right.
And so what they're saying
is... Did you
just
say Chicago like Chicago?
I guess
Bears,
I did.
The Bears.
So
okay.
What they said is, hey, do it in upstate New York. We've got the infrastructure of New York City. You can buy stuff there. We've got the people. We've got the smarts. We can handle any size show. Do it here and we'll give you a tax break. But it's not really a tax break, is it? Because I always thought when I heard these things about tax breaks and incentives, I thought it meant if you had a tax bill for making your show in whatever, in upstate New York, and you had a tax bill that you owed the state of like, you know, a 30% on whatever, you would get a reduction in your rate to like 25%. That's what I thought. You owe a certain amount of money, you don't have to pay so much. But what's happening is they're going to cover 25% of your expenses, of the production incurred expenses. So if you have total expenses of $4 million and all those expenses are covered under this agreement, you show them your receipts, they write you a check for $1 million.
That's right.
That's not a tax break. That's like cash on the barrel.
Yes, and there's
that's not how I understood it at all.
Yeah, well, I think it depends on the state, and it depends on what the tax bill is.
Well, yeah, of course, and the ruling and but it's not a tax bill. It's not a tax.
No,
bill.
But
it's not a tax. It's they spent $300,000 buying wood, and you give them your receipt, and they write you a check back for 25% of whatever you spent.
Yes,
that's
but
not
that,
taxes.
But that it's a tax credit. Okay, so what that means is, let's say you have a $10 million production, right? And of that,
I don't care what you call it. What I imagined was at the end of the year, you owed $374,000, and they said, well, we're going to lower your tax rate, and it's only this amount. But in fact, what it is you've spent this money, we're going to write you a check and hand you cash back.
But only for the tax. And what I mean by that is, if you paid payroll taxes or sales tax, they'll give you the money back for that.
No, that's not what this describes at
all.
That's
what
a
tax credit
is. 25% of expenses. It says a credit that would cover 25% of production-related costs.
Well,
it covers it.
That's not what a tax credit
is. If you spend $4 million, I know, but if you spend $4 million, they write you a check. All I ever imagined was that they said, well, you don't have to pay us as much as you thought. You can pay a little bit less. And in fact, the state is handing over cash, and that's exactly what's happening with House of Cards, the Netflix series filming in Maryland. This is how I came in. There's a great story in the Washington Post about House of Cards that one of our listeners, Aaron, sent to us. Thank you for that. It's by Jenna Johnson and John Wagner. It's about a legislative battle in Maryland with minutes to go before the final session of the year ended. It was literally 20 minutes to midnight when they were arguing over whether to extend a certain tax break that they had for productions done in Maryland. The producers of House of Cards wanted millions of dollars in cash, aka tax incentives, or they were going to take their show walking. Quote, if the two sides could not agree, the incentive program would stand at $15 million to be parceled out among House of Cards and other shows filming in Maryland, including HBO's Veep. These are different areas of the legislature battling over this particular bill, or however it's termed. I don't know if it's a bill or an addendum or what, but they're arguing over what to do. What they wanted to do, one side, was increase that incentive program to $18.5 million. They needed an extra $3.5 million that they could hand out to House of Cards. This is from the article. This is not a tax break, as you might think of it. Under this arrangement, a show filming in the state piles up the receipts for expenses that are covered, hands it over to the state, and gets a check for reimbursement. As I would say, that's cash on the barrel, not a discount on the money you owe. Maryland apparently also sets aside $7.5 million annually to reward film production that come to their state, but the annual allocation has not always been enough. So they have some other stuff that they do, and they have tax credits and things, however they call it. House of Cards has so far received $26.6 million in tax credits so far. $26 million.
So, get this. So when they say
the show cost $100 million, $26 million they got as a tax break from Maryland.
And that's how you make movies and television shows these days. You basically make a $10 million movie for $8 million. You have to come up with the $10 million initially, because then you'll get $2 million back from these incentives. Now, I bet if you read
But there wasn't a tax. This is not, you make a $10 million film, you do not have a tax bill of $10 million. That's the budget of the film. So if you're talking about taxes, to my mind, that means, well, you spend this money, there's going to be a sales tax and this other tax and luxury tax. That's going to be, I don't know, $800,000, and we're going to lower that for you. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about them handing over cash.
Well, I would be very interested to see the legislation, because I'm sure if you read it, there is some fine print about it being specifically, like, basically tax rebates.
But what I want to know is it worth it? I know every state has to offer these incentives or tax breaks or whatever you want to call them, or the production will go to another state that does offer it. But does it actually benefit the state? Is it a zero-sum game where, like, hey, if they come to the state, yeah, they spend money, but you got to give them so much money to come that you end up not benefiting? Or are they actually generating enough business that it's worth their while?
Well, from a strict economic standpoint,
there's no other standpoint in which to judge it.
I mean, a straight dollar for dollar. There have been some studies which say at best it's break even. In other words, really, should we be offering these tax incentives at all? Because frankly,
it does not offer enough economic benefit down the road.
Right. We are actually subsidizing these productions. We're subsidizing Hollywood. Why the heck are we doing that when they're
running around? Well, you're doing it because you have 40 people who get employed and then they spend money in the store. But you're saying despite that economic activity and all the money those employees spend, you're saying there are studies that say ultimately it does not really benefit the state enough. They spend too much to bring them there.
And there are critics of those studies saying, you know what, you're not taking into account all of the follow-on economic activity, such as what you just said, Michael, that you pay 40 people and then they go out and spend that money in your state. So there's, you know...
Right. Better to have 400 people employed than not employed.
Right. So really, I think the crux of it is directly, no, it's probably not worth it. But the follow-on economic consequences or economic activity is probably where you're making your money.
And these companies have the states over a barrel. There's always another state willing to offer you a discount.
That's right. And it's really become a war on Hollywood.
And there's no discount for our show, is there? Because it's free.
That's right. Although, please feel free to send us all of your tax money.
Yes.
Well, hopefully you're getting money back rather than a refund, having to pay.
Tax bill.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Thank you. There will be no bill for Showbiz Sandbox. In fact, you can download it for free, subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free. That's where you can find us. And if you do go to a place where, you know what, there are podcasts there, but we're not there, let us know. Let us know, and we will make sure our podcast, Showbiz Sandbox, gets listed in that particular podcast directory. In fact, you can let us know by emailing us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to all the stories we discussed on today's show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is at Showbiz Sandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our username, again, is Showbiz Sandbox. All of that information, one more time, showbizsandbox.com. Now, the music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Guess what? They performed at Coachella this past weekend on Saturday. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com, or next weekend at the second weekend of Coachella. Michael Giltz has a website. This week it is...
You might very well think that I couldn't possibly comment.com.
I have no idea what that reference
is. It's a House of Cards reference.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry and entertainment in general on that particular website, the name of which I can't even remember, why not go to michaelgiltz.com or thehuffingtonpost.com or even over to Bookfilter, his website about books. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.